Coming up next on Mac Break Weekly, we're talking about pre-order sales for the Apple Watch, existing sales for the brand new super skinny MacBook, worries about Photos app, and all kinds of other things we can worry about coming up in WWDC, coming up shortly on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 450 for April 14th, 2015. Blood on the wristband.
Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/MacBreak. And by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create beautiful websites, a blog, or an online store for you and your ideas. Go to squarespace.com and enter offer code MacBreak at checkout to get 10% off. And by Trunk Club. Have the wardrobe you've always dreamed of handpicked by your own personal stylist. Go to trunkclub.com/twit and join Trunk Club today for free.
It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Hello. Leo Laporte is off in Las Vegas at NAB, leaving me, Andy Notko of the Chicago Sun-Times, nominally in charge of the panel. But we have their usual powerhouse panel, including the guest panelist substituting for Leo that we most like to have. First up, Alex Lindsay, though, is back with us. Alex, how are you doing today?
Hello from Vegas.
From Vegas. So we're seeing a really good hotel room interior. What is your light source? Because your light source is gorgeous.
It's a window, which exactly. Turns out to not be, all I have is a big window. I'm looking out over Las Vegas right now. It turns out to be a very good light source.
Is it a high roller window or is it a deadbeat window?
I think it's a deadbeat window.
Didn't they dome over Las Vegas so that they could have one sun for the people, for the whales, and another one for the bus traffic?
No, I think the whales are right above me in the real nice places. I can see the little edge where that begins. In fact, when the wind blows, some of the metal is vibrating. Well,
if you're underneath, awesome. You can't see the whales breach, and that's the most majestic reason to have them. also with us for Imore is Renee Ritchie. Renee, how you doing?
Doing very well, Andy. We finally thawed out. I can look outside and see something that approximates green.
I know. I had to go for Boulder, but for like 2 days before that, the critters were back in the backyard for the first time in months. They were shell shocked, but they're ready to trust again. And the squirrels were like desperately trying to get at the hordes they buried like 4 months ago, but they haven't been able to get at because of the ice.
It's so, soggy greatness, Al. Andy, it's soggy greatness.
I will take gray skies and people playing baseball and being able to back into my driveway without having to cut the wheel twice. That's springtime to me.
Beautiful.
Filling in for Leo this week is Serenity Caldwell, also from iMore. Serenity, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Leo? I just called you Leo. That's really hilarious. How are you doing, Andy? I'm tired, but otherwise great.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I am guest Leo this week, but I don't have the guts to either shave my head or tattoo my butt.
There you go. I gave you the lower third. You're Leo now.
There you go. Cool.
Okay. Ooh, that's
this
right.
This is your new name. You've been christened.
Do I have access to Leo's corporate Amex?
I'm working on it.
Because everybody, I think it's bonus time here at Mac Break Weekly. Some of us don't have Apple Watches. Some of us don't have new MacBooks, but we can fix that before Leo gets back. Finally, we got some great stuff to talk about this week with both the start of pre-orders for the Apple Watch last Friday and also the start of availability for the new MacBook. But let's start talking about the Apple Watch. There are some pre-order sales numbers from a research group called Slice Intelligence. They have access to only U.S. data, and I talked to them a couple of days ago about where they're getting their data from. They have basically a sampling of 2 million users, and they have access to their e-receipts. But for whatever this is worth, they say that they figure that Apple sold roughly about 1 million Apple Watches pre-ordered. They're saying that two-thirds of those were the sport model, the cheapest model, of course. Each consumer spent an average of $504. The average order is 1.3, so you can get one for yourself and one for your 0.3 kids. The most popular was the space gray color, followed by steel, and the black band was most popular. Also interesting that 71% seem to have bought the larger as opposed to the smaller watch. Let's actually start off by asking, I want to know, who has anybody pre-ordered one yet? I will answer my own question first. I did not, because it was a $350 minimum thing, and I run an Android phone, so I couldn't really justify it. Alex, did you pre-order?
I have not. I went to pre-order, and of course, the first thing that I found out as I didn't really know what prices would be what. Of course, the one that I want was the most expensive one other than the gold one. So at first, I decided I had to think about that a little bit. And secondly, it wouldn't ship until July. And so I felt like I could probably wait now that I've missed the boat. And that was like 8 o'clock in the morning or 9 o'clock in the morning on Friday that I found out that it was going to be July. So they've obviously sold a couple, or they didn't make very many. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Keep talking.
I think that's interesting. You know, the reports of 5.5 million, it'll be interesting to see. But there's also so many variations. You know, so there's so many different options of how many fit into each one of these little panels. I think that's probably one of the challenges. But it's like everything else, probably need to be patient and figure out. And we're going to spend that much money. I do definitely want the one that I want.
Yeah, that was a big deal for me too. I did do another check of the store just an hour ago, and things seem to have improved a little bit because I couldn't find a watch that was not available later than June. So maybe they've figured out maybe when the container ship is coming back. Renee, did you pre-order a watch?
I did. I don't usually pre-order because I actually like going to the stores when they have lineups and they do the little song and dance routines and everyone, you know, claps and you come in, and I like all those festivities. But we talked about that Angela Aaron's memo press release last week and about how they were trying to push everyone online. So I wasn't sure there would be any in-store availability. So I broke down and bought the watch that Alex didn't get. So I'm thankful that Alex left it available for me. And then I got a bunch of bands to go with it. I always panic, Andy. Like when a waitress asks you what you want and you haven't made up your mind and you blurt something out. And I was saying, I want the black stainless steel, but then it won't go with the band. So then the silver stainless steel, but then I might as well get the silver aluminum. But then it's not, you know, it's not, the metal's not as, and I just ended up getting the black stainless steel.
And you feel like your place in line is about to go away. The short version of the most embarrassing social errors of my life, I wound up sticking a friend with the cost of a full lobster dinner because I arrived late, did not know that he announced he was going to be picking up the whole check. The waitress took about 45 minutes to get our order. And when I ordered the casserole I wanted to get, they were out and she was about to leave for another half hour. So I desperately said, fine, give me the lobster. It was a lobster place. So I know what you mean. It's like you see the countdown timer saying, give me the whale gray made out of dolphin beak, and you have an 81 millimeter one. I'll take the 81 millimeter one.
Exactly.
How about you, Ren?
I did pre-order. I pre-ordered a 38 millimeter sport with the white sport band. That was a late last minute decision. I was originally pretty gung-ho on the blue, and then at the very last second was like, well, the white might be more appropriate for all. I'm just going to go with the white. But I also got a Milanese loop thinking that, well, I really want a slightly fancier band for non-roller derby endeavors. And I really like the look of the modern buckle, but unfortunately it's $249, which is about as much as the sport itself. So the Milanese is a slightly less pricey $149, and that kind of sold me. And I'm like, well, I really like the look of it too. And when I went and tried it on yesterday, and actually even got the watch specialist to swap out bands so I could see how the sport looked with the Milanese, I was totally 100% confirmed. I managed to order in the first 3 minutes through the Apple Store app. And as a result, I think I'm in the original ship window, which is, I think, 4/24 to May 2nd. Hey, look at that. There's a thing up on iMore too that has more beautiful pictures of it that I posted this morning. I'm a little terrified about ship times because I had it shipped to my parents' house since I'm going to be down in the California area for Yosemite, for the Yosemite conference by CocoConf, which you're going to that as well, Andy, yeah?
Yes, I am.
Is that right?
Indeed.
Yeah. So I'm going down to LA after that. And I'm like, oh, shoot, I'm going to be in Los Angeles on Apple Watch launch day. So I'm really hoping that I had the initial launch and it's getting sent to my parents' house. Otherwise, I'm going to be back home and my watch is going to be in California and I'm going to be very, very sad.
Right. I hope that right now, through the chat room, throughout everyone listening live, you can feel the waves of sympathy and support as you say that you might have to wait 3 days till maybe the end of April before you get your watch. So, surely on this side of Jerusalem, none suffer as you suffer. No, but I'm interested in your thought process on buying it. Like, let's say if you could divorce yourself from the idea that you are a tech writer and people are going to be asking you for your opinions on this and you can generate a lot of different things to write about this, would you still have bought it just as a regular consumer?
I would say yes, primarily for the health tracking functions. And the fact that pretty much it all centers around roller derby and me being a jerk to people. The roller derby side is very much that I have yet to find a fitness tracker that accurately represents what I do on roller skates on a daily basis, which is to say the kind of high intensity sport that I play is not easily measured by steps because you're on roller skates and it's fast paced. There's a lot of movement. You're working muscles in a very different way than you are in other sports. And there's not basketball under most activity entries, right? You can't. Roller derby is so new that people don't quite know how to categorize it or know how many calories or how good it is for your body or bad, I suppose, if you get hit a lot. But the watch's tracking functions, while they don't have a roller derby insert per se, they track a lot more varied health statistics than your average Fitbit, for instance. And the combination of it also integrating with my iPhone means that for the first time, I will not have to carry a phone on my roller skates while I am coaching. I can just put the watch on and then I can use the watch to read off my drills and make sure, okay, we're on task. The time is, you know, we've gone through 40 minutes of our practice and we're still on the second drill. Got to speed things up. Previous to this, I would carry around my phone and pray that I didn't drop it anywhere like on the concrete floor that we skate on, or as happened to my brand new iPhone 6, the first 4 days I got it, I rolled over it because I set it down to do something. It didn't hurt it because pressure on these screens is actually surprisingly good. But still, it's like I would like to avoid destroying my phones while playing the sport that I like. So I'm really kind of hoping that the watch is going to be the thing for me. Now, it remains to be seen how durable it is when met with roller derby. I have high hopes for the Ion X Glass. I thought about going up to the Steel just for the Sapphire. But at the same time, I'm like, what if it does get scratched? And then I've just spent almost $1,000 on a device that I'm, you know, smashing around. Yeah.
Also, is there some sort of rule that says that there's a weight limit to how heavy and how hard a watch that you're swinging around on the end of your arm can be when you're playing roller derby?
Yeah, there is not. Well, it would be under my wrist guard. So I'm not really worried about it hitting concrete or hitting other people because it's going to be under my gear. But it is a general concern just in terms of like, I don't know. I wore a Fitbit for a while just out of curiosity to see if it could track things. And I've killed every Fitbit that I've ever owned from sweat. It's very sad.
Yeah. Andy, if I can my mom's never gotten a first-gen iPhone or iPad, but she saw the most recent commercial, and she wanted to order one, so I took her for a try-on yesterday. And she went there, and she went across the table, and she went and tried the machines while she was waiting. Then they showed her the watch, and she was super happy. She said one of the things that startled her is that she's senior enough that she has a little bit of arthritis and she has a lot of trouble with her jewelry, and she had no problem at all, especially with the loops, but with a lot of the bands. And her current watch gives her a lot of trouble to take on and off, and she really liked it sort of from an accessibility point of view. And then she thought it'd be great because she leaves her phone in her purse and she misses calls and she misses texts, and she's hoping that at least with the watch on, she'll see when, well, she'll still skip my calls and texts, but at least people she wants to talk to will get through.
Yeah, I've been following on Twitter. A lot of people have been very, very excitedly reporting on their experiences with their concierge appointments, trying on the watch. And it's causing a lot of delight and a lot of excitement, as long as you don't take a camera, because there have been a couple of people also tweeting that they tried to video it and they said, no pictures, please. I don't know why they had a Russian accent when they said this to these people.
No mirkit.
Yes. Exactly. So it seems to be a good goodwill gesture, at least. I don't know if it's translating into sales yet, because we're going to have to. I was a little bit surprised that Apple didn't have a big announcement as they did for other successful pre-order launches. Like, hey, we sold 6 million of these in the very first week, and we sold more in the first day than we sold of iPads in the very first year. So I don't think that means anything, but I think it's an interesting thing to note. Also, none of us seem to have been so gifted with pre-advanced hardware, so we don't have day-to-day experience. Let's note that there have been early reviews started to hit middle of last week. About half a dozen people seem to get them. Let's just acknowledge that it seems like every reviewer had something positive and something not so positive to say about it. Bit of a mixed bag. I can't talk about that because I have not been reading any of those, because I expect to get one in the next week or two for review, and I want my head to be clear for that. But Alex, what do you think about how these reviews are going to affect people's interest in the watch? Because it's still a brand new sort of thing. People still need to be convinced that they should start wearing a watch again, much less start spending $300 or $400 on a gadget watch. Are people really going to be scared off by any sort of a negative review, anything that's not the usual, oh my God, Apple's once again brought the Lord down to our world and put him in a watch, you know, that sort of positive review?
You know, I think that the first round of these watches are going to be picked up by people who are early adopters. There's going to be probably 3 to 5 million people that are going to buy these just because they want to be the first people that have them. And so I think that's not going to be affected by the reviewers. Most of those people have already decided they're going to buy a watch. I think that the next step is when you start seeing applications. I think the big cheerleaders for the watch are going to be the app developers, who are developing really cool, tools that allow you to use your watch. I was looking for it here, but I can't find it. There was someone at NAB that had that have comm systems, that you use, to talk to the rest of your team, and they had set it up so that you can tap the watch when you want to talk, like push to talk with your watch, and for me that was a very, very great, connection, to that process. And I think that as we see people doing really innovative things, apps, I think that's what's going to draw people. They're going to see something, or they're going to see a handful of things that get them really excited about what they could do with the watch. I think that's what's really going to push it. There's a lot of integration that may or may not happen, but I think that the timing is actually of the whole process, I think, has been masterfully kind of laid out, because you have this early launch, the pre-order. They're going to be able to realize those sales, or realize a lot of them, before the end of the quarter. They'll have they'll talk about that in May. And then you have WWDC, where they're really going to talk about, okay, this is how many have sold, and this is the real opportunity for developers. And then you're really going into the summer with a lot of developers who, if they aren't thinking about it, will be thinking about it. And I think that that's going to push a lot of watches, is the real use of them, more than, the first 3 to 5 million will just be people excited, but the next 5 to 10 million or 20 million will be people seeing something in their life that is actually going to be affected by the watch.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a big deal when people start having friends who have them, and they can actually ask them, how was the experience like? Right. Because I think there's sort of three tiers to reactions to the watch, or even reviews. I think the first tier is you've had it for a couple of days and you actually can use it in your own life. But then the next important tier is going to be you've been using it for an entire month and now you're totally used to it. And then the third tier will be once, as you say, a lot of these third-party apps that totally take advantage of Apple Watch come out there, and it stops being, hey, look, it takes time. Hey, look, it's a fitness tracker. I can take phone calls and I can do Siri from it. But when your favorite app on your phone is now also available as as a watch app, I think that's when people start to really fall in love with it. Renee, you're about to say?
I think you're going to see stuff like, for instance, being able to fire off your camera. I mean, obviously you'll be able to do it with your iPhone, but you'll see controllers where I can sit there and stand in front and tap my watch and it'll take a picture, or start video or start slow video in my field. But I think that those kind of things are going to, it's not going to take very many of those before people decide, oh, I got to have one of those.
Mm. Yeah. I'm sorry, Renee, what were you about to say?
No, I was just going to agree with Alex. I mean, I think one of the things that are interesting about the watch, we remember the, you know, it's an internet communicator, it's a phone, it's a it's an iPod, and the we remember the iPad was for reading and for watching, and they gave all these use cases where the Apple Watch, it felt a little bit more unsettled, like no one really knew what exactly it was going to be, and they tried to whittle that down at the last event. But I still think a lot of people will have completely different use cases. Like Serenity is going to love it for rollerblading and roller derby, and my mom's going to love it for notifications. And I might like it for something completely different, like home automation. And I think it has sort of these unique aspects. And everyone, if they find something like about it, will find one or two of those that really make a difference to them. And that's where they're going to go with.
Yeah. 1Password announced on their blog, I think it was today, that they're going to be supporting the watch. So that once you're done with your workout, you go back to your locker at the health club, you can actually pull up your combination for the locker there. WebMD has also showed off what they're going to be doing with the app. And it's going to be things like not just reminding you to take your pills, but here is what your pills look like. And here's how many you need to take. And also some sort of service where you can, it ties into a phone where you can then, if you need like a consultation with an actual doctor for $299, you can actually talk to a real doctor and a regular provider for this sort of stuff. And yeah, that's all that stuff is absolutely right. I mean, the delightful thing is not when you start to buy apps and install them, but when your normal apps start to update and your watch starts to do things it did not do 2 days ago. Like the first time, like Alex said, the first time I tried to take a picture, I noticed that on the bottom of my Android Wear watch is a little controller say, oh, if you want to trigger the shutter from here, by all means do that. Like, oh, isn't that nice? You figured that out on your own. Aren't you getting smarter and smarter, little watch? Go ahead.
I was going to say, and I think that also one of the things that a lot of people keep on asking me here is, do I think that the watch is going to kill all the other watches? And I think this is actually going to be a huge boom for Motorola. I think it's going to be a big push for Pebble, because there's going to be a lot of people that really look at the Apple Watch and get excited about a smartwatch and then get not excited about the price. You know, and I think that there's a huge market that's going to be wide open in the sub-250, sub-200 range.
Yeah, Wired has, The Verge had an article quoting sources they couldn't name that Google is very, very close to finishing an Android Wear component app for iOS, so that the iPhone will have most of the as much of the functionality as possible for Android Wear watches like the Moto 360 as they have on Android, which would be terrific, because I do see both Apple Watch and Android Wear as having two really different philosophies, and both of them are totally, totally valid. That's reason enough to support both watches. The other reason being that a lot of people can't even afford the $350 one, and we have really good, I think the best watch available for Android Wear is the Moto 360. It costs $200. And also, every single Apple Watch is the exact same style. And at least with Android Wear, if you want a round face, you can get a round face. If you want a square face that has a different sort of bezel to it, there are at least a half a dozen. Now I think there are 8 or 9 different manufacturers. And so I really do think this will shake things up and make things pretty good. That wasn't the only hardware stuff from last week. Also, Apple started shipping the brand new MacBook, thoughtfully named MacBook, so as to not cause any confusion between this device and anything else that Apple is shipping that runs Mac OS. Renee, your review for the iMore review just landed this morning, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And
what'd you think about it?
I really like. So there's a huge caveat for me. I really like it. It's got a lot of things that I think are incredibly practical. To me, it's almost like an iPad in Mac's clothing, where it's very light. It's Retina. It's got one port. It's made to be really accessible and appealing to people for whom computers might have always been intimidating, or who gravitated towards an iPad and then decided they need more of a computer. And I get people who complain about, you know, the keyboard or about the trackpad or about the lack of ports. But to me, the only caveat right now is price, because it starts at $1,200. The original Air started at $1,799, so it's not exactly. Yeah, $1,299, sorry. And the original Air started at $1,799, so it's not unusual for new computers to be pricey. But I think as years go on and this gets cheaper, I mean, the 11-inch Air is now $899. This will be a new generation of accessible computers. It will very much be sort of an iPad for Macs, and I think that's a terribly exciting idea.
Yeah, I agree. I was away last week, so I only got it this week, and boy, I'm surprised at how much I'm liking this, because people are sick to death of me talking about the limitations of the MacBook Pros. But I think they made a lot of really smart choices here. The trackpad, we've already talked about how just magical the trackpad experience is. It's not a clicky button, but it feels like a clicky button. My next bit of skepticism was going to be about this super, super, super duper flat keyboard with the new key switch technology. And it is super, super, super duper flat. It's like the flattest feeling keyboard I've ever used, maybe next to the Surface Pro, Microsoft Surface Pro 3, like the cardboard keyboard that that's the keyboard cover. And yet the fact that they made the keys bigger, it's... I've only written maybe about 800 to 1,000 words on it yet, but I can see myself getting used to it without it's not like it's slowing me down any. And you're right, there's something so compelling about this just tiny, tiny little object. Last week for the conference, I was going for an entire week and I packed grumpy. Meaning, you ever have one of those days where like you're packing and you're like you kind of wish you were staying home and like I got so much work to do, stay in the office, and they're like, I'm not going to take the laptop. I don't want to take it out for TSA. I don't want to have to carry my laptop bag. I'm just going to take my iPad with me. And so for good and for bad, I took my iPad with me. But if I had this MacBook with me in the office, oh boy, that would not have been an issue whatsoever. It's
one of the things that was. I was going to say, one of the things that was startling to me is I went back to using my 13-inch MacBook Pro today because I have a VPN on that I needed to do a few things with, and I hadn't set that up yet. And immediately the keys felt loosey-goosey. It took me about 3 hours to get used to the keys. But now these keys feel loosey-goosey, and I tried to force press to bring up details and messages and to bring up a file at some point, and it didn't work. And it occurred to me again how quickly our brains can make the new things seem normal and the old things seem utterly strange.
The new keyboard is absolutely crazy in terms of the fact that, like, I know Jason and Snell and I were talking about this a lot in terms of when you first type on it, especially if you're used to deeper, thicker keyboards, it definitely feels weird. It definitely feels like a little bit like you're typing on glass, which is to say that you don't have the same kind of deep indentation pressure that you're used to from a keyboard. But that said, I actually found that once I kind of got used to typing on it, I actually feel like I type a lot cleaner. Whereas when I'm typing on my MacBook Air, I feel like I'll hit keys the wrong way or my fingers will slip. But I don't know if it's the new key mechanism or if it's just the fact that it's slightly thinner, but I find that my fingers are almost gliding across the keys when I'm typing, and it's allowing me to type much, much quicker than I normally do, which is kind of, I mean, it definitely is going to take some adjustment. But I tested this again when I went in for my try-on appointment, my watch try-on appointment yesterday. And I find myself liking that keyboard more and more, despite the fact that I've always been a fan of kind of the deeper, squishier keyboards.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. And I wonder how much of it is just the size, the fact that they made the keys larger and they made the gaps between them smaller. So you can mishit them. It's not just it's a bigger target area, but that it's a flatter surface area so that if you mishit it by a little bit, it still feels like you hit it dead center. And it really gives you a sense of confidence. I had this thought that absolutely didn't occur to me until I started using it, that I can't believe I'm saying this, but if Apple decided to get rid of mechanical keyboards completely and just go with haptics to give that sort of little dunk sensation, I could sort of see that working, because when I move from tapping the trackpad, which does not have a key switch, to an actual key that actually does have a key switch, it's hard for my brain to process that there's a difference between the feel. So I'm not saying I'm asking for a keyboard like that, but I now my mind is open to it in a way that wasn't before.
I completely agree with you on that point. That's actually the first thing I thought of when I was handling it during the hands-on area, during the March event, where it definitely feels like they're getting closer and closer to the idea of experimenting with no keyboard at all, but taking force touch technology and maybe transplanting it over. Based on, again, the hoodoo magic that the force touch trackpad employs, I can envision, I don't know if the future is coming in 2 years or coming in 10 years, but I can definitely envision a point where the haptics technology allows you, as you brush your fingers across an otherwise smooth surface, if there's supposed to be a keyboard there, you get little tactical, not even buzzes so much, but it feels like you have individual keys. And then as you press down, it feels like you're pressing a key. Like I could see that happening.
Or a piano.
Yeah. Or, I mean, there are lots of avenues for that to work if you open it up to third-party apps.
Now, do you think it would work better if it's now just a glass screen that basically virtualizes whatever control you want? Or do you think you'd rather still have the notebook form factor, only you have this sort of space gray rectangle that is pre-printed with keycaps and backlighting, but can also be a game controller if you want?
Yeah, I don't think the pre-printing is necessarily a good idea because it does limit it to a certain extent. But at the same time, I'm not sure that I want, like, obviously haptics are coming to the iPad. It's going to happen. I don't know if it's going to happen this year, but it's going to happen. But do we want an iPad that still the keyboard takes up half of the screen and then you're limited to that little narrow window on a potential future laptop? I don't know about that. I'm not quite sure if getting rid of the form factor is the answer. Especially also you think about artists and you think about things like the Wacom tablets and the Cintiq. Part of the appeal for artists and for musicians and things like that is to work tactically directly with your environment and with whatever you have on the screen. But I feel like that differs from profession to profession. Artists want to draw directly on their screens, and they don't necessarily want a substitute if they can avoid it. Whereas someone like a musician might want that full size screen for their music and then want the second screen or the haptic surface to play their instrument. We're talking such future tech right now that it's it's really exciting to me, but I can't predict where Apple will go. I'm sure they're testing both though.
It'll be a great center console for the Apple car in 2018, that's for sure. Let's make sure we note that there are some big pain in the butt things about it, including that only one port. I'm going to be, as Ren mentioned, we're both going to be speaking at the COCO conference in Yosemite next week. And now I'm really am excited about using this as my only computer. And I was trying to work out the problem of, oh man, how am I going to drive a presentation from this? And can I spend $70 on an Apple adapter just to hook it up to the projector? And my mind has been so ingrained into the idea that video is something you plug a cable into. I forgot that, well, you could just take an Apple TV and use AirPlay and have that as a wireless thing. So it really is a machine that tries to browbeat you in a positive way into adapting the way that you work to work around the limitations of what you have. But Renee, are you worried about the CPU? What was your experience using this really not terribly impressive, let's say, CPU, fanless?
Yeah. It's Core M, which was codenamed Broadwell Y previously, and it's a super low power chip. And I don't think Apple has used them before, though other vendors have. But it's roughly analogous to maybe a 2011 MacBook Air. But a lot of people still use those, and those are still practical machines. It's just I recently switched from a MacBook Air to a MacBook Pro because I was on the road so much, and I do use Final Cut. I don't know, some people, you know, they want to use Handbrake or they want to use Xcode, and they want to do things that are high performance. And this is not the laptop for that. It's why Apple makes the MacBook Pro. And, you know, there's data out there about how many people actually plug into external displays and a lot of peripherals, and it's not many. But for those people, it's why Apple left the MacBook Air on the market. So I think this, you really have to know your use cases. And for a lot of people, I was joking about this before, but during the event, I got a text and people were like, only one port. I don't have to worry about what to plug in where anymore. That's a huge stress reliever for me. And as someone who's plugged USB into MagSafe before and had the computer shut down, I kind of appreciate where they're coming from. This really is almost like iPad level simple to use.
Yeah, it's Alex. The question I want to ask you about this sort of stuff, though, I like the fact that Apple has decided to not replace anything with this. It's clear that at some point the MacBook Air line is going to age out of the system, and then when people are ready for a one port or two port computer, this is going to replace it. And sometime in the next 2 years, 2 or 3 years, but there's going to be sort of a handoff period between the two. But as somebody who travels with computers and you have to do pretty intense stuff, is there like sort of a benchmark for you as to how you trade off something that's super light and portable and it's easy to get from job to job versus something that you're not willing to compromise tech specs for?
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit that I carry both. So I have, you know, I think of my little 11-inch Air as kind of a the little shuttle that comes out of the Enterprise. So when I'm, you know, I have a retina, at least one of them, usually in my backpack that I can, that I'm really doing work on for the most part, whether, you know, jumping into visual effects or Final Cut or whatever. And then the little one is just what I put in a small bag, in a small bag that I can, you know, walk around and still know that I can get connected. I think that, the problem for me is that I, unlike you, I'm very much addicted to my MagSafe because I have kids and, I may have frozen here. So we'll see if you can,
Sounds like good time. Yeah, sounds like a good time as any to go to a commercial. We were going to reach out in the dim past the grim specter of Leo Laporte from an age-old time with this message from Audible.
Thanks, Andy. We're going to interrupt just for a little bit so I could tell you about Audible.com. Then back to more of Mac Break Weekly. I mean, Andy's a huge Audible fan. We all are. We love listening to audiobooks on Audible. I think I win in terms of the longest Audible subscriber. I started subscribing, I think, February 2000. You know, you can look. One of the nice things about Audible is all of your books are always visible online and downloadable. So it's kind of like your library. Right now I'm listening to Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader. It's actually great. We've been talking about that. Some of these are Andy's recommendations. Patton Oswalt's Silver Screen Fiend. Still waiting to get to that one. As You Wish, the behind-the-scenes story of The Princess Bride. Audible has so many great books, both fiction and nonfiction. Lots of great science fiction. I'm reading the new, just starting Otherland, which John Slonina has recommended. So this is my first Audible book. Yeah, February 7th, 2000. So I have been an Audible member now for more than 15 years. It is a lifesaver. Can you believe that? It is a lifesaver. I started listening to Audible when I was commuting to the Screensavers. I had a two-hour commute, sometimes 2 hours each way, depending on traffic. And Audible kept me from going crazy. In the car, at the gym, walking the dog, washing the dishes. Lisa and I both listen to Audible all the time. And, you know, there's so much choice. So here's what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to get you your first title absolutely free. Go to audible.com/MacBreak. Audible.com/MacBreak. You're going to sign up for the gold account. That's a book a month. What I do is I alternate fiction and nonfiction. So right now, listen to the Steve Jobs book. I'm going to go into the Otherland series as my next book. One of my favorite books of all time, Cryptonomicon. I have it. I'm just saving it because it's really long. I'm saving it for a moment when I need a break. I need to be uplifted. There's Laszlo Bock's Work Rules is supposed to be amazing. The HR guy at Google is supposed to be incredible. God, The Art of War by... So here's the deal. Go to audible.com/MacBreak. Sign up for the gold account. This is funny. Littlefinger narrates The Art of War. Now that's good. Let's hear it.
Said, the control of a large force is the same principle as the control of a few men. It is merely a question of dividing.
It is Littlefinger. Who better to narrate Lao Tzu's The Art of War? No one. No one. Audible's so creative, I have to say. Go there, pick a book. There's so much great stuff. Your first one's free because you're going to get the gold account. That's a book a month. First month free. You also get the Daily Digest of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal as part of your subscription, of all subscriptions. Now, you can cancel in the first 30 days. You pay nothing. You keep the book forever. It's yours forever. But I don't think you're going to want to cancel. It is so amazing. Martin Short, I must say, my life is a humble comedy legend.
The man is an idiot. Nevertheless, after questioning both candidates, the interviewer declares...
I have to say, I love... listening to these autobiographies by comics when they read them themselves, it's just hysterical. Look, I shouldn't have to say anymore. Just go right now. If you're not yet a member, audible.com/MacBreak. Pick a great audiobook, get it for free, and a whole world of listening is going to open up for you. audible.com/MacBreak. Back to MacBreak Weekly, Andy Anatko.
Thank you, voice from the past, Alex. Leo. Actually, before we leave the new MacBook, two quick notes. One, that it seems to be shorted just the same way as the watches have. They're supposed to be on sale starting on Friday, but if you go to the Apple Store, you're going to have to wait about 4 weeks for your delivery to arrive. And also, while listening to Leo tell us about Audible, I said, hey, I wonder what happens when you use force press on Omni Outliner, and it crashed Omni Outliner. So clearly... Clearly, there's going to have to be some people updating what to, how these how their apps adapt to force touch trackpads.
I still want Jalco to make a Mars Edit button where if you force press it, it turns everything upper caps to all caps, and you blog angry. I think that would be spectacular.
or at least it should actually talk to your Apple Watch and get a pulse rate. To say that. And if your pulse is above that, you know what? We're just not going to let you post this. We're gonna cache that release. Say it'll post in 24 hours. You have time to pull this back, just in awesome. Case your lawyers say, "Oh no, 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 oh no, 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 no." We also had a new iOS drop last week. iOS 8.3, long feature list as usual. The kinds that some leap out and some are. Oh, so you've actually changed the stack nature so that a stack overrun that is only possible when you're using a certain kind of keyboard does not happen when you're connected to a non-pleased network. But the coolest, the coolest features that I've been playing with is that the amount of diversity that Apple added to emojis of all things. So now that any emoji that is a human emoji, you can adjust the skin tone. There's also emojis that show families. Now there is same-sex couples represented as families. It's little stuff like this that actually is when you improve these finer points of the experience of using something, that's when you really get a big smile on your face. But what else is in there? I mean, is it? I did read that there are some. It was breaking Touch ID for some people, but I'm not having a problem with it. Renee, have you heard of anything? Any reason not to update to 8.3?
No, yeah, some people did have a Touch ID problem, but if you disabled it, rebooted, and re-enabled it, it would come back. It was mainly for App Store app purchases. Some people got confused, too, and they thought that Touch ID wasn't working in third-party apps. But when you reboot your phone like you do when there is a new iOS update, you then have to launch the app that holds the extension, type in your password, and authorize that. Mostly it's with 1Password. You got to put in your master password, then it re-enables Touch ID for all your apps. And I think some people, we reboot so rarely now that people forget about that when updates occur. But also, yeah, it fixed a ton of security stuff, which was I was really happy to see.
Yeah, and those I was looking at the list yesterday or over the weekend, and they were the usual esoteric stuff that doesn't look like they're going to affect much of anybody, but if you're one of the lucky 1 in 100,000, that's probably a good thing to close up. One of them is sort of was a lingering bug that if someone is trying to force you through a proxy, they could do some nasty things and lock you out.
Yeah. And IP box was another one. They'd fixed it previously in 8.1.3, but they double dog dared you to try and break it now.
Yeah, and it seemed they all seem to be the sort of stuff where, like most angry, fear mongering. Oh my God, the iOS is now insecure. It's like a really long sequence of events has to happen in the proper order in order to render your device vulnerable. But that doesn't mean that you would like to have your device vulnerable. More interesting is that Apple dropped a new beta of iOS 8.4, showing us a new tech towards the music app, which, boy, am I happy to hear that, because just last week I was reminding myself of why I don't use the music app on my iPad very much, because it's just so hard to use. Has anybody downloaded the beta yet?
I have not.
Okay.
I was busy MacBooking.
I'm technically not officially allowed to see whether I have or not.
Okay. So we can say that there have been published reports to allude to the idea that creating custom playlists is a lot faster. There's a rumor that it will also be possible to, when you create custom playlists, to add your own artwork to represent it. There is also a very, very well-sourced rumor about new hooks for iTunes Radio to make that more prominent. Since there's stuff that we can't talk about, I suppose, on this show, let's talk about what we're hoping is going to happen to music. I'll tell you that I'm very, very surprised that Most of my music is available through through iTunes Match. I can use the native apps if I want to, but I find myself using the Google Play Music app, and I find myself using my Amazon Music Cloud Music app because they're just more reliable. And it's, Ren, do you have the same problems, or are you happy with the current app?
Oh God, I'm so unhappy. I listen to a lot of music. I don't have a commute because I work from home, but I have a boyfriend who lives 45 minutes away, an hour and a half in traffic. So I spend a lot of time listening to music, or I have been in the last couple of months doing that drive. And I've very quickly discovered just how much I hate working with the music app in terms of it's hard. It's the organization is difficult, especially if my car is only partially integrated with Bluetooth. So it's very hard for me to quickly search for songs. And the only way that I can try and get things to work is usually by like, hey, Siri, sorry to everybody who was listening, play this song. And I don't know. I have some problems with the music app, even off of that as well. I was trying to make a playlist the other day for like a roller derby thing. And when I was trying to make this playlist, I'm like, okay, I have these songs, and I go to add songs, and some songs you tap on them and they just won't add. And it's not an iTunes Match error, because I was adding songs that I hadn't personally downloaded to my iPhone, but just some songs wouldn't add. It just no idea why. So they're little bits here and there. Organization. I love Beats, so I'm really kind of hoping that Beats's custom playlists, as well as some of their technology, is either integrated into iTunes Radio or replaces iTunes Radio. It would be real swell.
Yeah, I've now, to save all of us, I've pulled up the article from 9to5Mac. So we're just quoting 9to5Mac here. quote, and 9to5Mac quotes the release note saying that it has an all-new design, a beautiful new design that makes exploring a music collection easier and more fun. Recently added, which is a feature that I've wanted for so long, albums and playlists you've recently added are now at the top of your library, so you don't have to figure out, now, what album did I add? And is it alphabetized under The Beatles, or some sort of stupid studio thing. iTunes Radio has been streamlined. There's a new mini player now that a new, a better now playing list, so that's easy to see what's playing right now, what's going to come up next. And another thing that, have you ever had that experience where the thing that you can't make something work, and the only thing going through your mind is, I must be really stupid. Because it must be right in my face. I can't believe I'm so stupid that I can't find the search box in the music player, because obviously that's like the first thing you put in there, a big button marked search, because I can't believe I can't. I must be drunk, or maybe the oxygen here in the airplane. And then, no, it's because it's just so darn hard to find. So supposedly there will be a new new global search. You can now search from anywhere in the music app. Just tap the omnipresent magnifying glass and search results.
I don't remember. You guys remember, but I don't remember Apple doing such a core application in a beta, like a point release beta, before. They almost always wait for the big number, like the 8 or the 7 or the 8 or the 9, to show off the new music app. It's interesting to me that they put it in 8.4.
It's kind of interesting that they wouldn't do that to as part of the rollout for the new Beats Music integration.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't expecting any news about this until June, WWDC, but maybe, I don't know, maybe there's other cards that left to play, or maybe just the people inside Apple are sick of the music players as much as we are.
Because we can see Craig going, we've got a brand new music app for you. Let me show it to you. I'm going to miss that now.
Yeah, well, I mean, okay, so here's the other thing, is that 8.4 may just be a preview of some of the things that they are working on. There's nothing to say that that Craig still doesn't have an all-new music app up his wrist, which might well be paired with a new version of iTunes. The sleeve was completely unintentional,
iTunes,
but yeah. Oh my gosh, please. All right, so there was a great little app made by a developer who I think later went to work for Apple called Seamless, which was an editor's pick of mine from way back when, I think 2011, Seamless did the exact same thing, essentially what then Continuity did, where it would hand off the song you were playing in iTunes to the song you might be playing on your phone, so you could just walk out of the door and theoretically continue listening to where you left off.
Daredevil with me as I leave the room.
Yeah, exactly. But it hasn't been updated because I think the developer went to go work for Apple or another Silicon Valley technology company. And I'm so bummed because I really want that feature. Apple, it should be so easy. Why is it not?
Yeah, you ever get the sense that you're walking through like a house that is only 1 month away from getting its occupancy permit because you can see the stove and the fridge are all hooked up and the water's connected to them and there are bathrooms and there's stuff like this, but there's no carpet laid yet, and so there, and there's a lot of like bare walls. That's sometimes the feeling I get when I walk through iOS and macOS, that I see so many great components that are just waiting to be hooked up and then one switch flipped to make all of this work so amazingly well. Although I'm a dope and I've been sort of saying that about the music app for the past 2 years, probably, which is why that all my music is now in Google Play or Amazon. Other updates, though, I've got an update to Final Cut, which dropped just yesterday. Alex, I think I'm going to ask you about this because I'm guessing you know more about Final Cut than I do.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a dot release update, but there's some really interesting things that are in it. Now, there's some basic stuff that's kind of more technical, some different support for Red, RAW, as well as being able to open more than one scope. I think that those are things that I'll get excited about, but I'm not sure if everyone listening would be that excited about. The big news, of course, is 3D text. So, and it's really more than just 3D text. It's a 3D renderer that's, you know, inside of Motion in Final Cut. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of performance, a lot of underlying bits and pieces, but one of the things about this is that they've really kind of experimented with making it a lot easier for the average person to, you know, use, you know, 3D text. And I think that, you know, my guess is, of course, this is kind of a dip in that pool. So so what you can do now is, you know, you can have your text there and you can just select the little selector that says, I would like this to be 3D. And now it's, you know, now it's extruded. And one of the things that they did that was a little different is, you know, guys like me are used to like really setting up all the materials and putting it all together. And Apple did what Apple does, which is they simplified everything. So they said, you know, you can do metal or plastic or stone or wood or concrete, and you can even add layers. So you can add extra substances on top of those. But they really stopped talking about surface attributes, you know, specular versus diffuse versus reflectivity, and really just went shininess and thickness, and we're going to add these things. And at first, when I first turned it on, I was like, oh, I don't know if this is a good idea, because you kind of feel like, as someone who does 3D, you feel like you can't get a hold of everything the way you want to. But as I've started to play with it a bit more, I think that for the average editor and for a motion designer, this is going to be great. I think we're going to see a lot of really interesting things with it. So I think that is, you know, and you can do things like, for instance, it only handles text right now, but you can, if you went into a font editor, take your logo and make it A, you know, and then you can extrude your logo out. So there's a little bit of a, you know, roundabout way to bring your own graphics in. It's still just a straight extrusion. It's not whole 3D models. But it's obvious that there's an engine in there. It looks great. I mean, the renders, look really nice. There's a lot under the hood there that you can really get into. So I think that was the big thing that they added for there. There are some other things that are interesting around compressor that kind of let you, you know, deal with a variety of issues that you would need to publish more effectively to iTunes, which I think, you know, could be really interesting that's becoming more widely available. You know, that might be a precursor to things in the future. You know, I don't know that for sure, but it definitely is interesting that they're making it much more easy. I mean, it's always been one of those things that I've always been kind of surprised by, is that Apple has basically an entire vertical market, all the way from when you're creating content to when you're watching it on TV. And I've never felt like, kind of like what you were talking about with, you know, all these things not being quite hooked up. You never feel like that pipeline is completely, and probably on purpose, completely connected. But it feels like they might be connecting that a little bit further. So
how important is it that they've improved support for compressor inside the app itself? Have they added, taken features from the compressor app and put it inside Final Cut, or is it just an integration thing?
You know, I believe that there have been some additions of taking some of the compressor pieces, and I haven't really tested that heavily. And I have to admit that that has more to do with me than then I wasn't on a beta or anything of Final Cut, so I just got it. I've been in a hotel, so I got it late last night. Finally, after, you know, as you can see with my connection here on Skype, it was like that, downloading a big file. So, so I haven't tested it that heavily. I usually kind of glaze over the compressing in Final Cut conversation because I just don't do that ever. So I don't. I'm really old school about, I want a Apple ProRes file to come out of Final Cut, and then I'll put that into compressor so that if anything goes wrong with the compression, I have my file that I'm now just working with that. I'm not opening up Final Cut every time I want to, you know, to recompress something. So I have to admit, I've never been a very good tester of that, of those tools of being able to compress straight out of Final Cut, because I kind of have a religious, objection to rendering straight to H.264 from any of my contribution software devices.
I was going to ask, why do you think the compressor is so hard to use? I have it. I try to figure out how to make it work, because I'd much rather have better. When I do videos, I'd much rather have higher qualities, lower file size. But it really is. It's for somebody with, I don't know, 9 years of ITG Technical like Institute plus post-grad. Yeah, exactly. Is it just never intended for somebody who is not a professional in the video field and a high level professional to use?
I have to admit that I've been using compressor since pretty much day one, or a little before day one. And so for me, it's always been there was a big jump when they went to 10, where there was a big interface change. But for me, it's always been kind of incremental, so I don't think I notice it as much. I think that. There's oftentimes just with QuickTime, I used to just have little QuickTime settings that I would still use to get something out. I think that the big advantage of compressor is that you do have a lot of control. The problem you really get into is with great power comes great responsibility. And so I think a lot of people have trouble. There's so many little buttons in there that you can grab onto, and you can really, mess up your files. I don't really use any of the presets that are in compressor. So I have my own little presets that are there's like upload to YouTube, upload fast to YouTube, which is slightly different compression setting. And so I have a couple of, a lot of different things that I use for outputs. I think that you do have to have a little bit, if you're going to open up compressor, you have to have a little knowledge of how compression works and what you're doing to your file. It also, there's a lot of management issues. One of the big advantages of compressor is it is blindingly fast on the newer Macs. I mean, I can remember back in the day when we were talking about the compression time being, 2 minutes for every 1 minute of content. And now it's like 10 seconds for every 1 minute of content. I mean, compressor is, incredibly fast on the modern architectures. And because of that, I use it all the time, just because I don't want to, I used to think QuickTime, you'll get something relatively good out of it. The old QuickTime 7. And now I'm fairly, the compressor 10, and I think that Final Cut will do this. Is crap.
Okay, but now since we're on Final Cut, though, do you think that pros are, is Apple making pros happy with Final Cut now? Is the mutiny of a few years ago kind of over with and forgotten, or have the people who are going to leave already left?
Hard for, I really like using Final Cut Pro 10. I liked 7 as well. I feel like 10 made it much easier to do some things and more obtuse to do others. But I can't answer the Exodus question, because I'm no longer really actively working in film, and I can't be like, I'm not going to speak on behalf of other people, but it certainly feels like the drama and the fervor has kind of died down a little bit. And, people are either quietly switching to Final Cut Pro 10, or the people who are using, continuing to use Avid, continuing to use Premiere, other apps that better suit their needs.
And I think that, I dropped out again. I think that the interesting thing about it is that I talked to a lot of folks who the folks that are really, that were high end film guys that were using Final Cut went back to Avid or went to Premiere. There's this huge group of people that have entered the Final Cut. And I think they're kind of invisible to a lot of people, because they're not the guys working on Conan O'Brien or whatever. But they are, just average folks that just want to get their edits done, and I think that a lot of people are finding that it's just a lot faster and easier to put that together. And so the things that our big pluses, of course, is that, you know, it's $300. It's not a subscription. It is not, we haven't paid for an upgrade since it was released. You know, if you're an average person kind of putting that stuff together, that's pretty compelling. Once you get used to using it, I have to say that it's very hard to go back to the older platforms, you know, like the older way of approaching things. I've been editing on some kind of nonlinear editor since 1993. So it was definitely a process for me to kind of get into that. But Final Cut's so much it's so much faster to get most work done that, you know, by the time I would normally organize a set of files, I'll have the edit, you know, largely done. And so it's just very hard to, like, especially for journalists or anyone trying to do anything with that are fast turns. Like, to me, when they say they're using something else, I kind of internally just go, well, how's that working for you? Yeah. Which is usually, that's my nicest way of saying that's crazy, you know. So
what's your blood pressure today?
Yeah, exactly.
So. That's been on my mind because last week I haven't even downloaded it yet because it's part of the things I need to catch up on after a week of speaking for like 3 hours a day for 5 days a week. Apple released Mac OS X 10.10.3, and the highlight is the new Photos app. Renee, is that the official release? It's officially out of beta now?
Yep, Photos for OS X and iCloud Photo Library, all of them out of beta and into your life.
I should have guessed because iMore has a wonderful multi-part series that explains all about Photos. I'm trying to figure out, I'm hoping you're going to help me out with this because I'm an Aperture user and I'm the sort of person who will put on the artistic beard and say, you know, my needs for photo editing far surpassed those of a consumer-oriented editing option. I mean, there are things I understand about light and feels and emotion that I don't think that simply pushing sliders around in a free app are going to do. So obviously you and Ren have been spending a lot of time with Photos. Will somebody who wants to do more than tweak brightness and contrast have a lot of fun with Photos, or is it really going to be, here's your excuse for moving to Lightroom now that Aperture has been killed?
So I'll let Ren handle the bigger picture. My quick take is, because I'm an Aperture user too, but I would say 50% of my Aperture use was right-click edit in Photoshop, because I'm just way more used to Photoshop. And this is similar to me. I can get away with using Photos because right now there's a one-click send to Aperture button. So anything that even if it's just, I could do it, but I don't know how and I don't want to spend the time learning, I just send it to Aperture. So right now I feel like we're in a really safe place, Andy. We don't have to make any hard choices yet, but there's a lot to like. And like I said, Ren's been spending a lot of time on that part of it.
Yeah, Ren, I mean, I've been starting to learn Lightroom because I know that at some point I'm going to have to know how to use it better. And also, I didn't want to start the investment in Photos. Do you think that I'd be better off trying to learn how to build workflows for Photos? Or is it a limited option, do you think, for editing?
I really think it depends on your needs. I've used Photos for Mac since the first developer beta came out. And I am of the opinion that if you are anything under a frequent prosumer, which is to say that you have a DSLR and you take a lot of really awesome photos on vacation or you wander around, say, the Boston Common and take a lot of photos, I think actually any of those use cases on down to super beginner, you'll actually really like Photos. Because Photos has those super basic sliders, yes, but those super basic sliders can turn into much more complicated sliders and get yourself additional little widgets like levels, contrast and brightness, a histogram so that you can see where your colors are being integrated. It really... Again, I feel like it's your personal use case and it really depends. But what I would suggest is if you're interested in at least playing around with Photos and seeing if it's potentially good for your use case, take 500 to 1,000 photos or even just one batch of photos and create a tiny Photos library that isn't connected to iCloud Photo Library. Just make yourself a demo Photos library and play around with the editing tools. It's a free program and it comes installed as part of OS X, so it's not like you're losing money or really time to give it a quick whirl and test through. And if you don't like what it has, or if it doesn't currently suit your needs, then you don't have to use it. I do think that from a management perspective, and especially when you incorporate iCloud Photo Library, if having your photos available to you from any device is important to you, photos is a must have. And the editing process, unfortunately, OpenIn does not currently work, which is very annoying for me. And it's something that I really hope that they fix in future versions. Even that said, the cumbersome process of taking the photo, exporting the photo out and editing in Photoshop and popping it back into your library, that's worth it if you want to be able to carry around all of your images. The fact that I now have a 15,000 photo library and I can pull up any photo I want on my iPhone 6 at any point in time. I did this while I was traveling in Pittsburgh. We stopped over at my friend's mother's house and we were talking about cats. And I was like, oh, I used to have a cat that would try and climb out my window and he would like paw up. And I'm like, let me see if I can find a picture, because I took like a billion pictures of this back in 2010. And I knew it was 2010. So I just scrolled up. I found the cat photo in probably 5 seconds, 10 seconds. And I showed it to her and she wasn't even looking at the cat. She was looking at my tiny years grid. And she's like, how did you get all of your photos on your phone? I want to be able to do that. Can you tell me how to do that? That's amazing. So I really do feel that photos is incredibly useful if you want your large library on your phone, or at least potentially referenced on your phone. And I go into greater detail about why that I think that's important in my photos review. So I don't want to take the entirety of MacBreak Weekly on going on and on about photos. But, you know, for that subset and for, again, prosumers on down, I think it's great. If you're a professional photographer, you will be unhappy with photos. It is not Aperture. It is not Lightroom. It is not designed to be Aperture or Lightroom. Apple may fix some things. I really hope it fixes some things. I hope it adds some more brushes than its tiny little retouch button. I hope it adds edit in an external editor other than just this weird add to Aperture button. But for the time being, I think it's a remarkably stable 1.0 release. And I feel like a great number of people will be very happy with it. Professionals, no, you still got to either use Aperture or Lightroom. I'm sorry about that, but it doesn't seem like this. Apple is not solving your dilemma. Apple is not positioning photos as an Aperture replacement a la Final Cut Pro 10, being like, I know it's kind of loosey-goosey, but we'll fix it later. No, they're like, this is the photo editing program and management program for the vast majority of people. If you don't fit in this little box or in this like very big container and you fit instead in a little box, we're sorry. We'd love to support the little box, but we can only do so many projects. We already have a watch and a Mac and maybe a television and maybe a car and all of this software.
We didn't say television. Yeah, it's obviously a real slam dunk for consumers. I mean, the ability to simply, I can make an edit on a photo and I know that no matter what Apple device I have, I can access that photo and show it off. That's just, it's such a really great reinterpretation of how people use photos in 2015. As good as whatever they had before that was working, it was really like a 2002, 2003, I will upload it to a public photo album, then share out that album. I've been trying to figure out what Apple's motive was, though, in killing Aperture. And one of the things that was on my mind is, well, maybe they're actually saying that the new framework is not just this Photos app. It really is a whole architecture for photos on every single device that Apple makes. Maybe they're saying that you'll be able to do as much with Photos plus maybe a $30 or $40 plugin that a third party will come up with as you could with Aperture or Lightroom or anything else you'd like to use. So I do have the developer build. I've been trying it a little bit, but certainly not as intensively as you have. So I guess the other big question for myself and so many other people, Ren, can I trust giving it one of my Aperture libraries or my iPhoto library, or do I? My instinct is I'm going to create a copy of my Aperture library on my current MacBook. I'm going to put it on a flash drive and I'm going to mail it to myself by route of Kazil to make sure it's 3,000 miles away before I show photos this library. What's the worst that can happen? Okay, let's not say the worst that can happen is that asteroids kill us all while we're trying to get my photos loaded in. But realistically, can I feel as though I can trust photos with my existing libraries?
Yeah, well, so the number one concern that you have that photos might otherwise I'm stuck using
Photos, and now I can't just open up an aperture and stuff like
so
that.
So when Photos looks at your aperture in your iPhoto library, it doesn't actually convert it. So you actually can still keep on using Aperture with that original library that you made way back when, or iPhoto with your original iPhoto library, even after you have converted the library, because it's actually not converting it. It's making a hard like a second copy with hard links, which basically allow it to take up the same amount of storage space, despite the fact that theoretically your hard drive thinks that it's taking up twice as much storage space, but it's not actually from an overall picture. It's just sharing the data in between libraries so that if you're, you know, you can still keep on editing in Aperture, you can keep on editing in Photos, but your management is entirely separate. They're two separate libraries. Something you do in Photos will not reflect in Aperture and vice versa. But if you delete your Aperture library or if you delete your Photos library, your Aperture library is still fine or your Photos library is still fine. It's not going to destroy one or the other if the other is not. It's not a symbiotic relationship. You can part them if you want, or you can keep them together on the same hard drive and run them side by side even if you wanted to. It's not a huge problem. In general, I feel like it's totally worth taking the jump and just being like, I'm going to test this out. And if it's awful, I will just delete the Photos library and then whatever, then we're cool. Or honestly, I know a couple people, friends of mine who are doing this, who are actually using Photos as a way to just store their final finished edited photos, their sort of marquee products, so to speak. And then syncing those with iCloud Photo Library. So they do all their work in either Lightroom or Aperture. And then they're using Photos as a way almost to have a portfolio so that those photos all sync across all their devices. And in addition, if they have optimized storage on and they're not storing them locally to their phone, they can pull low-res versions of those photos up even while they're offline. So if, like, you know, my friend James, who takes photos, is sitting on a plane and he's suddenly sitting next to a National Geographic photographer, he can still pull up a low-res version of a photo he took 5 years ago in Africa and show it to the photographer without it having to be stored locally on his device. And I think that's really cool. That's like a big plus of Photos for me over something like Dropbox or even Creative Cloud, where it's like, if I don't or can't store all of my photos on my phone or my iPad because of space reasons, iCloud Photo Library allows you to have sort of those low res, very minimalistic space taking up copies, and allows me to look at them even if I have no internet connection. And if I have an internet connection, it allows me to pull it down almost immediately from the great expanse of iCloud. Back to your essential question. If you're an Aperture user and you want to give Photos a try, you can import your Aperture library and nothing bad will happen to your Aperture library. You don't need to mail it to Brazil and back. It can stay on your same computer. If you're really terrified, you can make a separate copy of it. In fact, I recommend everybody back up their stuff before trying something new just on, you know, point of principle. But overall, I found Photos to be incredibly stable when importing other libraries and doesn't screw with it at all.
Coolness. Well, we need to go to commercial, another ad. But before we do, do you think that we're going to have to all upgrade our the size of our iCloud libraries in order to make room for all these photos that we're going to be starting to sync in? I'm on the 200 gigabyte plan. Do you think I'm going to need to get more?
I'm on 200 gigs as well. And so far, that seems to be okay for me. I think I've filled up something like 80 gigs. Granted, I don't have a super ton of raw photos in this library. Most of it's just high quality JPEGs. I do feel like if you have a gigantic library, you may need to look into upgrading. I know some people's hesitancy is like, oh, God, I don't want to pay for another storage plan. And I feel that because I'm already paying for Dropbox and then all of these other, you know, the pay TV subscription. Like, I've got a lot of computer subscriptions going on. It's kind of crazy. I will say that, again, going back to like having the reference photos and the fact that your photos are being kept securely and privately, which means that there's no chance that Apple's going to use your photos and make ad money off of it, or use your photos to try and determine what you might like, you know, the way that you might run into trouble with some of the free or ad supported services. I really like that aspect of it. I like the fact that it syncs so seamlessly into the Apple ecosystem. And much as I loathe paying an extra $4 a month, I feel like it's worth it for my needs. May not be worth it for everybody else's. Yep. Again, it's I really stress, I think, with almost anything Apple related or anything technology related for that matter, it's like, if it doesn't fit your lifestyle, that's okay. Like, just because one person loves it and thinks, oh my God, this is the perfect thing for me and I can't believe it wasn't available sooner, doesn't mean that that's going to be the same thing for you. And if it's not, then that's fine. There might be something else for you. It's no big deal.
The only wound that sometimes we suffer is that Apple has a wonderful plan for all of our lives. Apple likes to remind us that we thought about this way more than you did. So, Andy, don't worry your pretty little head about how to connect things to your MacBook. We've planned that for you. But how about this one thing? We've planned this for you. But I can't close it. Andy, thank us and say goodbye. We've planned this out for you. We're going to be taking a break. Let's go once again to Leo Laporte from the distant past to tell us a little bit about Squarespace.
Thank you, Andy Iannacco. We'll be back with more of Mac Break Weekly in just a bit. But first, I got to tell you about our favorite web hosting company, Squarespace.com. You know what's great about Squarespace? It makes sense. If you're Squarespace, their webpage is their homepage is always different. Beautiful. It's gorgeous now. They just do such great stuff. They have the best designers. Now, let me explain what Squarespace is. It's not just a hosting company. When you get started at Squarespace, you will get... choose your first template, and they've got some gorgeous ones. And I'll tell you in a little bit why these templates are extra special. But let's just pick Momentum. You'll set up your first site. And you can do this, by the way, absolutely free. You don't need to give them a credit card or anything. For 2 weeks, you've got the site. You've got the hosting, but you've also got the software running on top of it. And there's a real advantage to doing it this way. Because Squarespace runs the software, they know the software, and they're using custom-built web servers to work with the software, so they get a really incredible performance and linking, and it just works so well. Every Squarespace template is what we call mobile responsive. That means it looks good on everything from an iPhone to a 55-inch television. And when you upload an image, it'll resize. It actually make, I think, not 8 or 9 different thumbnails of that image. You notice right here on Momentum, the big screen, the 27-inch version, has the doggy, and the little mobile version has the doggy and the mistress holding the doggy. This is a full bleed template. That means the pictures go all the way to the edge of the screen, and they look so great. Every Squarespace template has e-commerce built into it. But more importantly, they're all customizable. So these are sites, actual customers using Medium, and you can see each one looks different. Each one's unique, and that's why you're going to like this. Squarespace lets you create a site that reflects your unique abilities, your unique style, but it gives you such a great head start doing it. And you can try it for free at squarespace.com right now. No credit card needed. If you want some help, Squarespace has live chat and email support 24/7 right from their offices in New York City. They start as low as $8 a month after the trial, and they do the hosting, they do the software. You even get a free domain name when you sign up for a year. I love Squarespace's new cover pages thing they have. I love it. It gives you a beautiful one-page online presence in minutes. It's also great for a kind of a one-off site or a quick landing page for a new product, that kind of thing. By the way, if you live in the area or if you're willing to move to the New York area, Squarespace is hiring engineers right now who are ready for the next step in their career. That's why they created NY Commit. It's an initiative that will select up to 10 engineers from all over America to, oh boy, I wish I could do this, to experience the history, vibrancy, diversity of New York City. If you apply today and the interview before April 30th, you and your spouse or partner will get a complimentary weekend in New York City. They'll fly you out. They'll put you up. To learn more, go to nycommit.com. This is a great idea. Boy, this is a great idea. You can see Squarespace is a great employer. Start a trial at Squarespace. No credit card required. Start building your website today. When you sign up for Squarespace, all I ask, use the offer code MACBREAK. That'll let them know you heard about it on this show. And you'll get 10% off, just as a way of saying thank you. Squarespace, build it beautiful. We thank Squarespace so much for their support of MacBreak Weekly. And now I send you back to the studio. Wait a minute, I'm here. Andy Iannacco.
Sending you back to the future. Just before we started recording, Apple announced the date for WWDC 2015 and started the lottery. It's going to be June 8th through June 12th at the usual locus of insanity, the Yerba Buena Center. And people can start applying for tickets today through Friday, and I bet they're already gone. Renee, the tickets are already gone now, right?
It's a lottery like last year. So basically you get to throw your hat in the registration ring. And then I forget when they said they announced the date that they'll be telling you whether you were laboriously hand selected for a ticket or not. And then they'll charge the associated
Monday,
credit
April
card.
12th.
Yeah, Monday,
yeah,
April 12th.
Random selection process. It's like being drafted. It's like Monday, April 12th, 20th at 5 p.m. Isn't it kind of amazing that people are going to like, oh, my God, I'm so lucky. I won the opportunity to spend $1,600 to go to a trade show. But lots of if you really need to know things firsthand about development, hardware and software, you're going to have to be there. Am I overstating it?
Yeah. Well, so the labs are always going to be the labs. There's only so many Apple engineers, and they only get so much time to actually interface with the developers. But this year, if you read the fine print, they're going to be streaming a ton of stuff, which means that if you don't get the ticket, it's way better. It used to be months, I think, before you get the videos. And recently, over the last couple of years, they got it to almost so it was day and date. It'd be a few hours after the session. But in the description this year, it says that they're going to try to stream. It doesn't say everything, but it seems like they're going to be streaming a lot more than just, you know, the usual keynotes and State of the Unions, which means that if you don't get a ticket, you can still come for the drinks. And actually, I think a lot of people are going to rent rooms and join their friends and just watch them over the air.
That would be cool. Just like around the Super Bowl, if you don't get tickets to the Super Bowl, at least you can still like be part of the Super Bowl community for that week.
Party.
That seems like unusual given like the historical nature of WWDC. It used to be where the San Francisco is on lockdown. If you go there, you're not supposed to write about this. You're not supposed to talk about this. You're not supposed to wear the T-shirt or the blazer until 3 months afterward. And now is everybody going to be able to watch these streams, or is it going to be you need a developer account in order to do that?
I mean, last year you were supposed to need a developer account, but it was unlocked for a surprising amount of time. And it might still be unlocked if you go to developer.apple.com. I don't think they still ask you. And they were giving journalists passes to the entire event, not just for the keynote. And the basic NDA had changed so that you couldn't show screenshots or video, but you could still – people were basically live tweeting State of the Union, which had never happened before. So it in many ways, it's a whole new WWDC.
Is there any upside to Apple having secrecy at this point?
I mean, I don't know. I would say that anyone who's been in the industry long enough can kind of look at any platform and see what the most likely observable holes are. And, you know, spin a lot of commentary off that. So I think this new climate is better for developers. They seem happier. It seems less constrained. I think it's a net positive all in all.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with Renee there. I do think that there is a certain amount of it's important for Apple to maintain a certain amount of secrecy, especially when it comes to developer APIs, because when you're talking about, you know, obviously these are available to anybody who has a dev account. But at the same time, a lot of it's very technical. It's very technical, and it's very much I don't know. I feel like if we were given free rein to write about everything that happens during WWDC, we would probably end up with a bunch of our readers being like, why do I care about WatchKit API that allows developers to call sign brackets? You know, it's a lot of this stuff isn't necessarily interesting for the average user. And also some of the stuff is talking about features that won't officially ship until the fall. It's the same reason why Apple really isn't thrilled about sites like 9to5Mac writing about the music app in 8.4, and why, you know, on iMore we try and like keep ourselves to mostly published software, because we don't want to either hype up a feature that changes in the official build or something that may disappear entirely by the time it's released. Those kinds of things can really not only from Apple's point of view make users mad at them and be like, well, I bought this for this feature because I saw it on this website and now it's not here. But from a journalistic point of view, if we're telling people and we're writing how-tos about features that haven't been released yet, and then we're basically doing disservices to the people who read us and the people who rely on us for good information to help to like help them make decisions. Because if we're telling them things that they can't actually use, how is that helping them?
Yeah, and I think the other problem is that this is information that Apple has put together for the benefit of developers, and they're speaking developer language. And if you have a journalist, no matter how tech savvy he or she is, they might not have that broad understanding that allows them to understand the context that's being presented in. I mean, every time that I'm trying to process a piece of news from WWDC, I have to call like a whole phalanx of seeing eye nerds to say, well, I think that this means this. Am I off base or on base? And say, no, you're not playing baseball. You're playing football there, son. And that's the problem of when Apple's trying to communicate to developers, but the whole world starts listening. So you mentioned, Ren, you mentioned WatchKit. That's certainly, I think we're kind of counting on Apple releasing the development kit for third-party watch apps at WWDC.
I'm hoping hoping that we'll see it for more realistic is the wrong word. more thorough watch kit options. Right now, of course, developers have largely been limited to essentially handoff applications, things that are running on the iPhone and pushed to the Apple Watch. But I'm crossing my fingers that we might see stuff like that, more standalone apps appear at WWDC. We'll have to wait and see. It may be a constraint, like as much as I really want to see full-featured apps this year, it may be a constraint of the current generation Apple Watch that it just won't, you know, it doesn't have the horsepower, or it doesn't have the battery life, or any number of other things to potentially run full applications. And if that's the case, we may be kind of stuck in the same kind of like iPhone to iPhone 3G limbo. Only it's a little bit better than last time because we're not limited to web apps. These handoff apps are actually pretty full featured and pretty awesome, and they can store a certain amount of info direct on the watch, so that you know you could still use the app even if your iPhone is not necessarily directly by your side. But I don't know. I'm kind of up in the air on whether or not we'll see it at this year's WWDC or we'll see it during next year.
Yeah, not to reopen watch, but that's something that's been on my mind a lot. That I kind of founded a Twitter storm a few days ago, but 2 days before pre-orders started, by sort of saying maybe you want to consider not pre-ordering this one, knowing that it would be great advice for anybody who was looking for advice. And the people that are the best audience for the first generation don't care what anybody says, pro or con. They're going to buy it anyway, because I'm with you. I think it's going to be like the first iPhone, like the first iPad, where there's going to be a lot of stuff coming up. And I feel as though there's a lot of stuff coming up in 2016 that the first generation won't have the hardware to handle. Although it'd be hard to imagine Apple not having native watch apps, at least in time for the Christmas buying season, when I hope they'll have enough stock on hand. Alex, is there anything that Apple could possibly announce at WWDC, or at least tip their hand to, that would be really, really welcome news to you? I'm trying to, when I heard about WWDC this morning, I was kind of like making a mental list of, here are all the rumored things that we've been hearing about, things that are picking up velocity that would need developer support, and Apple would either want to announce it at the WWDC keynote, or they would at least through some of these sessions tip their hands to what's going to be possible with the phones and the iPads next year. Is there anything particularly that you're kind of on tenterhooks to hear about at WWDC?
I really want to see something with Apple TV. So, to me, I think that, you're looking at an iOS platform that is completely undeveloped. I think that Apple's getting serious about it. I think that there's a real opportunity there to do a lot of development. I mean, I think when you think of it as a game platform, communications platform, there's a lot of things that can be done with Apple TV. And I'm not talking about big TV. Oh, man.
Oh, we lost Alex again. Hello? I think we've lost Alex again, because he's looking contemplative. Renee, same thing to you. What are you looking for? Not even a prediction, but what are you hoping to learn more about, or at least see some movement on at WWDC?
We'll assume that iOS 9 and OS 10, 10.11, Apple's not getting out of the computer business. So we'll see those things. But I'm going to echo Alex. I think Apple TV was last updated spring 2012. The little box has sat there kind of forlorn ever since. And Apple's got all this great technology now. They have the A7 and A8 processors. They've got Metal. They've got an SDK that's, not to keep saying this, has been sitting up on bricks for a long time. And I think if you put all those things in the field, when you have things like the Apple Watch and HomeKit and all these other sort of like there's always been a limit to what Apple could touch in our lives. You had to have a phone, you had to have an iPad, you had to have a Mac, but it was very little beyond that. And now that they've decoupled interfaces and they've sort of unbundled functionality, an app is no longer an app. An app is now a series of discrete things that you can do almost anywhere. It just seems like it's going to be really interesting when you have CarPlay and HomeKit and HealthKit and AirPlay and all these different things and an Apple TV that ties into that. It seems like the lone thing sort of that we're still dragging from the past. And I think when we have, you know, the watch, the pads, the iPhone, even the new MacBook in some ways, it's going to be a very big, big, bright WWDC future.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, no, not to oversell it either, but I mean, I was kind of in the dumps with Apple about a year and a half ago because I saw a lot of lack of movement on everything that I thought was going to be a really good idea and not a whole lot of signs that Apple is terribly interested in things that aren't making them bucket loads of money at this given moment. And it's like what I was saying earlier, I see so many components sitting around that, oh my God, they're building a giant fighting robot. They are building a fighting robot. Giant robot, because look, there's the big purple fist over there, and over there there's like the antenna that will fit onto the head, and all they got to do is snap this onto that. So it's I'm pretty excited about WWDC, even if we've already seen the watch, even if we know we're not going to see, or excuse me, we're pretty sure we're not going to see a phone, and other things don't seem to make much sense. I want to see all these things connected together. We will be back with our picks of the week after past Leo tells us about Trunk Club. Leo,
thank you, Andy. They say guys don't like to shop. And I've been thinking about that. I like to shop. I like to shop for gadgets. I like to shop for tools. But I don't like to shop for clothes. And that's why I was so glad. Right? Right. There is no guy alive. That's why we look like the way we look. Because we want to give me a t-shirt, shorts, flip-flops. I'm happy. Even Mark Zuckerberg. How rich is Mark Zuckerberg? Billionaire. Wears hoodies and flip-flops, shower shoes. We don't like to shop. But what if somebody shopped for you, picked the stuff you really liked, put it together, beautifully displayed, and said, what do you like? And what if they did that for you for free? You only pay for the stuff you keep. That's Trunk Club. And I love Trunk Club. Your own personal stylist. Mine is Robin. You can't have her. She's really great. Actually, you probably can. I like to think she's a one-client gal. Robin is, I talked to her for about half an hour, told her what, you know, I'm a preppy, I'm kind of chunky, you know, gave her all the feedback. She picked out some great stuff, put it up on a website, and then Lisa and I looked at it and said, nah, yeah, no. And then she put together the trunk. This is not my first trunk. I loved it so much, I got another trunk. By the way, this costs nothing. You don't pay for the shipping or returns. You don't pay for Robin's time. You only pay for what you keep. That's it. So I haven't opened this yet. It's going to be my first time. This is the biggest trunk. This one's really big. They do such a nice job, though. You'll be so excited when your trunk arrives. I can't remember what we... Oh, wait a minute. I got on sideways. There we go. I can't remember what we told her this time. So one of the nice things they do is they give you an envelope with return mailing. You see how they tie it nicely and everything? Great stuff. Oh, my gosh. Okay, I'm definitely keeping that. Probably not that. This is nice. This is like a pea coat. Oh, I can't wait to try that on. So here's the deal. You're going to try all this stuff on. You're going to see if you like it. Anything you don't like, you just throw back in the trunk, send it back. They pay the shipping. This is a return shipping envelope. You only pay for the stuff you keep. If you keep nothing, you pay nothing. Now, we asked her for some neckties. Oh, I love this. Look at that. Isn't that beautiful? All right, we're keeping that for sure. I love this one, too. Beautiful shirts, sweaters, but it'll all depend. You know, this is my stuff. It'll all depend on what you say. Oh, look at that. See, the nice thing is I don't know what's trending and hip. Robin does. So if Robin sends me a bright red tie, I know people are wearing that. That will look good. I should wear this to my presentation. Should I? All right. I got a presentation in Vegas. That's why I'm not here. Oh, look. It's like a pocket square. Oh, that's so cute. That goes with a tie. Oh, that's so cute. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm going on and on about my trunk. Your trunk is awaiting for you. So is your stylist. Oh, this is made in Italy. This is an Italian shirt. That is. Do you like that? I like that. Your stylist is awaiting right now. Go to trunkclub.com/twit. You'll sign up with your stylist. It will not cost you anything. It's free to join. There's no subscription fee. Shipping is free. Returns are free. There's no minimum purchase. And they don't send you a box every month. It's not a subscription. It's not like a Book of the Month club. You talk to your stylist whenever you're in the mood for more stuff, and she'll send you stuff, and that's it. It couldn't be easier. Gorgeous clothes, handpicked for your style. You don't have to shop. You just have to talk to Robin. Trunk Club. No, you can't have Robin. She's mine. TrunkClub.com/twit. Oh, I love this cable knit. That's beautiful. See, it's interesting because this is the second box. She's totally, she's refined what she's sending me. It's like the first box, I kept a couple of sweaters, a few things, some shoes. This box, I'm probably going to keep most of it because this all looks gorgeous. Oh, look at this jacket. It's a Vince, you know. See, I don't know from labels, but then I show this to the ladies and they go, oh, you got a Vince. Yeah, I got a Vince. I know my way around finding wardrobe clothing there. TrunkClub.com/twit. Try it today. You're going to love it. Andy, you could use a little Trunk Club. Andy and Iko.
Yeah, Leo, you got a point there because, and this is no joke, last night I was on eBay buying a secondhand sport coat because I had seen a fellow speaker at last week's conference wearing one just like, and I thought, yeah, I bet I could pull that off. And I'm a monkey see, monkey do sort of self-tailor. I need help. I need assistance. I need my mom to come and just, but if not for my mom buying me clothes for Christmas, I would have nothing sporty in my wardrobe at all. Let's get on to our picks of the week, starting with Alex. Alex, what you got for us?
So my pick of the week is a new camera that I'm having a lot of fun with. I'm doing a lot of spherical work, so shooting, lots of, stuff for, the headsets and so on and so forth. And the one that I actually shoot with looks like this, which is very much of a spaghetti mess.
Is that a spherical selfie stick?
It's an everyone-y stick. It is an ISS space station and the worms in the ground stick.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what I'm shooting with. And obviously carrying that around all the time is hard, but I want to test things and think through things and try to figure things out. So I got this little thing called a Theta. This is made by Ricoh. And this has lenses on both sides. You can see right there. This has got lenses on both sides. And what it actually does is shoots a spherical video or still in one click. So if I want to do this here, I just hold it up here and might have heard that little. So anyway, that'll be a really weird photo.
And in black, we've all forgotten all about what you're telling us.
Exactly. It does feel like that when it makes the noise. So, I shot a video and the audio is a little rough, but I shot a video of my mom, her birthday was a couple weeks ago, blowing out the candles. Like, so it was like you're sitting at the table, and you put it on, and it's a, it is kind of the next generation of selfie because it's a selfie, you've had ones that are front and back, where you get the two photos. This is like you talking to someone, like picture with them and everything that you were standing inside of at the same time. I will like to say in my own defense that I did order black and somehow I ended up with pink, but I needed it. So I kept it. So anyway, I've done stuff like I suction cupped it to the front of my car, which makes a really odd experience in a Gear VR because it feels like you're sitting on the hood of the car. So,
what can you do with the video? Is it like it records a standard video file?
It creates a video file that is that's two halves, and then their software will stitch it together. And their player will do it. There's some players online that are capable of playing it, but you can see, there's someone who took it. And what's really interesting is look at it. Wow. It looks like you're just pinching. It looks like you're just holding up your hand, and because it maps itself out of the picture.
Clean your thumbnail first.
I do regret that I bite my nails now because I keep on looking at these photos and they're like, oh man, that's rough. So but it's got a 1/4-20 on the bottom so that you can mount it to tripods and do all that other fun stuff. So there's a lot of other things that you can kind of get it away from yourself. That's probably a better solution. And it's just I'm really, I really enjoy it, of like, this is where I was. This is like the whole, there's some good examples there. Anyway, it's good.
Yeah. It's how much is it? Alex?
Oh. Not gonna tell us.
Now we don't
he
know
got
whether
through
the
we review could... at least.
Yeah, exactly. We'll find out next week
on the exciting conclusion.
Exactly. We will find out how much that is in case we don't get Alex back. And until then, Renee, what do you got for us?
So I've had a long and abiding love for an app called Snapseed. It's on iOS and Android. It was by Nix Software, and they got bought by Google. And Google is a big company, and I understand they can't always put all their attention everywhere that I'd like it all the time. But they sort of left it to fallow for a long time, felt like years and years. And it just sort of got older and older, and I used it less and less. Well, finally, and I'm going to use the full-on italic bold version of finally, they've released version 2.0 of Snapseed. I think it was last week, and it is awesome. I haven't used it on Android yet, but on iOS especially, it is terrific, most of all because they actually took the time, they actually cared enough to implement PhotoKit, which is Apple's API that lets you tie into the non-destructive edit pipeline that iOS 8 introduced. So theoretically, you can do stuff in Photos. You can do stuff in all the different filters in Photos. Yeah, and you can do stuff in Snapseed. And then if you later change your mind, it's not, oh, I have to go back to the original and painstakingly reproduce this entire chain of events, except changing that one step that will lead me to a better, brighter future. But you can just go in and twist the knobs and dials and change just the part that you originally changed with Snapseed. The downside is not everything, including some of Apple's stuff, doesn't support the non-destructive edit pipeline yet. But Photos does. And for a lot of people, that's their primary way of getting to all sorts of pictures on iOS and OS X. And I just couldn't be happier. It is, I don't know if it's a complete rewrite. And I don't know if John Knack was specifically involved, but I feel like when he arrived there at Google from Adobe, magic things started to happen.
Yeah, he's been really active that way. I'm sorry, Ren, you were about to say? I'm sorry.
No, I didn't say anything.
Okay.
In that I'm case, just listening that was in contentment.
Exactly. Basking.
Yeah, it's just terrific.
As usual. As usual, basking in the Renee wisdom. But so long as we've got the camera swung around to your Ren, what do you got for us this week?
All right. Well, I've got a physical item and then a bonus iOS app. We'll start with the physical thing. So I've been carrying around I looked for a new backpack at the beginning of the year because I was going to be doing a lot of traveling between CES and Ool, and now I'm going to Yosemite. And I wanted a good tech backpack to carry all of my tech things, as well as to just, you know, carry some miscellany. And a friend of mine was like, oh, you should try Osprey. I know they usually make hiking backpacks, but they also make these really awesome tech backpacks. So this is the Osprey Pixel. And I've been testing it for about 4 months. I got it the first week of January. This thing is amazing because it can be really, really slim or really, really big, depending on whether you need it. It looks nice and it has a million pockets, which is what I love about backpacks. So I'll show you the side. I feel like their actual video. So it has a side pocket that fits both a laptop and a super side pocket that will fit a 10-inch iPad. And all of that is easy access right on the side. So if you're going through a lot of airports, you don't have to open your bag and dig through all of your stuff for your laptop, which I love. I had never seen this on a backpack until I picked this up. And I know that lots of backpacks have it, but it was still one of those, like, my mind is blown. It has these, like, all of the zippers to expand or contract the backpack. It has a top zipper here where you can put front things. I have like an iPhone cable just in case. And I think there's a battery pack in there as well. On the bottom, I haven't even opened the bag yet. On the bottom, there's this little pouch, which will fit a DSLR with a 40mm pancake lens in it. And it's actually the perfect place to hide a DSLR because it's, again, easy access and it's padded. And then you open up the backpack itself. There's another zipper pocket here where you can put like pens, and I've got more cables. It comes with a cable organizer and it has giant bag space for anything you might need. And
more pouches and more
pouches. And you know what? I never knew that this was important until I found it on this backpack. It has a handle on the inside. So if you have the bag open and it's on the floor, you can pick it up and dig through it while you're still holding it without having to be like, oh, where is that? where can I charge my phone or my computer?
It's so, also awesome that the lining is like a bright color. It's not black, so it must be easier to find things inside there too.
Yeah, I really like it. I only got it for $120. So it's not even, you know, super, super expensive for a nice backpack. And it's made out of the same materials. That's a gray herringbone, which, again, I feel like it looks really classy. It doesn't look like your average geek backpack. And it does have that nice sort of neon interior. But it's also, it's made with the same kind of like high quality construction materials that you'd find in a hiking backpack, so you don't have to worry about it ripping. And there are extra clips and snaps if you're putting on something particularly heavy. And that that top cover over that holds the main compartment in it can be expanded or contracted as necessary. So I've stuffed things up, like I had a bedroll in there. I could theoretically go hiking with this backpack and have tech stuff, which is pretty cool. I used it extensively when I was in Ireland, and I really, really liked it. So that's my hardware thing. My software thing is more of a quick shout out. So I forget who mentioned this game to me. I have become addicted to a Japanese cat game, which I think Tiffany and Marco are meant are to blame for this, because Tiff was talking about it in Ireland, and then I went for it. It's called, I think, Niko Atsume. The game is entirely in Japanese. So the first time I saw it, I'm like, this is insane. I don't understand what to do, but it is adorable. It's basically you put out things, you buy little like food and cardboard boxes and other random things. And then little tiny cats come to visit you from, who knows, neighboring environments. And they come and they play with your toys, and then they leave you sardines as gratitude. And it's like, it's this little, you know, it's set it and forget it. You just go back every so often and you put down little things. But all of the cat animations are so cute. There's like one of the cats is playing with the ball and it just teetles back and forth. They're really well designed. It's a really well designed, very adorable little game. It's total fluff. Like it's totally something that I'm just enjoying, but it gives me the same kind of like weird glee of actual pet ownership without the stress of like a Tamagotchi or like a hatch pet, where it's like, I have to check this every 5 seconds or the pet will die. With this one, it's like, the pets just wander in and out. They're not yours. You can take pictures of them.
Like a real cat.
Yeah, exactly. It's the cat is not at your beck and call. It is not there to amuse you. It just happens to enjoy itself, and you can occasionally peek in on its delight. So it's my perfect like happy time app. So I'm going to recommend that to everybody. I'm so sorry in advance because it is kind of addicting. There are in-app purchases, but you can totally get away with not doing them at all. It's just, again, just playing with adorable cats.
Oh, that's not a bad thing at all. Do we have Alex back? No, we do not.
No. He's dropped. He's not coming back. Dear. Although I will tell you, just to kind of round up his review of the Rico Theta, it's $300.
Okay, that's not too bad.
Yeah.
And for collecting stuff that you can't collect otherwise, I had a 160 something degree lens for like my Nikon Coolpix 990, and I was showing off my at my parents' house. Oh, here's how well this camera works, and oh my God, look, my parents had never seen a digital camera before. And then like only 2 or 3 years ago, I came across those just stupid pictures I took just to show it off. Like, oh, I have 360 degree views of my mom and dad's living room. Oh, I have 360 degree views of the kitchen. And there's a time when you're going to be an older fool and like, you know, your parents are going to be gone and your parents' house is going to be sold, or events that are going to be long, long gone. And maybe, oh, look, it's just like being there again. Isn't this lovely? I don't have to decide where to point the camera. So that's pretty cool. My pick is a free piece of software that I discovered last week. A lot of us are using if this then that, that really cool like web app that does like internet rules, where you just set up a recipe like if the RSS feed for this podcast is updated, take the episode of that web podcast and copy it into my Dropbox folder inside this folder. And it's just what is the thing you want to trigger an action, and then what action do you want it to do as a result of that trigger? And you can almost like you get to write apps yourself, even though all you're doing is connecting an action to a consequence. They have released a camera app for both iOS and for Android, and it is the simplest thing ever. It is, I'll hold it up like that. It is a recipe app where it takes pictures, but then you could basically get to tell it what you'd like. Hey, I could actually frame this up. There you go. almost like being there. So you can actually set it up so that, for instance, this is an Evernote recipe that I've set up so that every time I take this picture, like if I've just had a business dinner or something, all I have to do is switch to this camera and then click the button. It will take a picture, and then that picture I take of the receipt will then go into Evernote inside the notebook that I keep receipts in. And you can define like multiple cameras. So, for instance, here's one that you take a picture, it will automatically just be tweeted. Here's another one where whatever photo I will be emailed to myself. You can do things like if you're often sending pictures to your parents, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your kids or something like that, you can basically now define a camera that is, this is the camera that whenever I press this button, whatever picture gets taken will be shared with my folks. And there is a very, very wide recipe library available. These are obvious. These are simple and obvious ones. But if you tap on that recipe box right there, you can start to either use recipes that other people have created for you, or you can start creating ones of your own. For instance, you can do things like take a picture of something and then your Hue light bulbs will change color to match the color of whatever it is you just took a picture of. And it's one of my favorite kinds of apps in that it's a tool that you use to create new tools. And because I'm not even a competent Swift programmer, I would love to have certain apps that do really tricky things that only I would appreciate, but I'm not going to spend a few days or a few weeks writing that. But when you have a tool like this, if it involves taking a picture, then doing something with that picture, it is super quick, super easy. And it does pass my chainsaw test, where after you use it for the task for which you downloaded it, do you start walking around the house seeing what else you can do with it? Yes, you do. And that's how you wind up with a old sofa that you've been meaning to take out of the guest bedroom, and now you can carry it home in a shopping basket because you've cut it up with the brand new chainsaw that you were having so much fun with. That's it for MacBreak this week. I'm sorry that Alex Lindsay is gone, but he's in Las Vegas. He's gone to a better place, I'm sure, a mid to high priced hotel in Las Vegas. We also have this week Renee Ritchie from iMore. Renee, what else is going on this week in iMore that we should know about?
Oh, I think it's recovery now, Andy. Watch stuff. We're going
to
ramp up.
You're not allowed to recover. You're a trusted news resource, Renee.
We're ramping up for the Apple Watch, Andy. That's what we'll do next.
Exactly. And Serenity, want to make sure that everybody checks out the stuff you wrote about photos, because it really, for me personally, again, I knew that it was going to be waiting for me when I came back, and I spent like Friday and Saturday saying, oh, that's good. Oh, okay. So I know how to do that. What else is going on?
Well, we're working on photos. We're also continuing our Apple Watch ramp up coverage. I just posted a thing I think I mentioned earlier on my try on experience, including matching the sport with different bands, including the Milanese Loop. I'm going to write later on why I'm choosing a 38 millimeter over a 42 millimeter watch. I know a lot of people are having kind of a discussion who haven't been able to try it on yet. Well, do I need the small one? Do I need the big one? What's going on? We've got a buyer's guide up there. All kinds of other fun things. I'm going to be continuing to write photos how-tos, because even after the 55 plus how-tos we wrote for iMore, people are coming in with questions, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's a great point. Let me explain how to do that for instead of trying to fit it into 140 characters. Let's make this an actual post. So a lot of photos, triage, some Apple Watch stuff. I'll probably bump. I did a guide on playing Hearthstone that just hit on the iPhone right now, and I know that's a secret guilty pleasure for me and quite a few other people. So if you're interested in that, I'm sure you can find that on iMore.com. Just all of the things.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Serenity and I and Jason Snell and Jim Dalrymple and a whole bunch of legitimately cool people are going to be at the Yosemite Cocoa Conference next week. I will be there with more photo equipment than I'm going to have to go through every single closet to get every single camera that I can to see that. I'm going to be finishing up my MacBook Pro review soon. I've got two or three other things in the hopper. Got another Apple Watch piece coming in. I'm trying to be a little bit more discreet about Apple Watch, because it's like I think I have 9 things to say about it, and I've already said 7 of them. So I got to make sure that the remaining 2 I really put it out there when it can create the last with greatest impact. Leo Laporte will be back with us next week. Until then, thank you so much for watching this week, and get back to work. Brick time is over. Gold bricks. You got time to lean. You got time to clean.
Epic.
Didn't realize I was paying you to Facebook. Hope you're doing a good job of it, because I'm giving you $14 an hour to do it.